Right.
Yeah.
So in the midst of that year, before he was leaving, he got married. Mm-hmm. We were at his wedding together. I still know that she is fully involved with him.
Mm-hmm.
He's married now. He has a child.
Oh, my goodness.
And then the spring right before he was leaving, we had him. I had my, like, last chance to qualify for nationals and fell off the beam five times. Just, like, total reflecting back. Well, I was in no emotional state to be, you know. So we went into a rest stop, and he kissed me on the mouth.
Oh, my.
And then
welcome to the Healing Ground Movement, a podcast dedicated to revolutionizing how we think about our bodies and our health. I'm your host, Dr. Carly Hudson, DC, and I have lived my life in pursuit of holistic healing and care that goes beyond symptom management. If you've been listening and like what you're hearing, head over to your favorite platform and leave us a review so we can reach more people with our important message. Enjoy today's episode.
Welcome to another episode of the Healing Ground Movement podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Carly Hudson, and with us today we have Tori Ivanek. Did I say your last name right?
We say it like Americans, just Ivanek.
Ivanek. Like, Van. That's yeah. My maiden name with the Cates. But
yes.
I digress immediately. But with us today is Tori Ivanek. She has a background in conventional and homeopathic healing. She believes that one must feel better before they can think bigger and live the life they want. She helps people struggling physically or emotionally through homeopathy and helps people live their best lives through masterminding. She is also the author of a book that I am so excited to have and dive into here of her own personal story, No Big Deal, From Athlete to Advocate, a memoir of childhood behavioral and a journey to childhood trail. And a journey to justice. So we'll talk a little bit about her history and her story as well today. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's fun to be here, live in person even.
I know. We're kind of on, like, this is 3 or 4, and I'm still stumbling over in, you know, real life interactions, but it gets easier every time.
Yeah. Great.
Even with the 6 feet between our chairs.
Exactly.
But to get to know you a little bit today, and you were, I'll do a little spoiler on your behalf, you were a gymnast as well, but I know movement has always been a big part of your life. When was it first fun for you? When do you remember it?
Absolutely. Well, the reason I ended up in gymnastics mm-hmm. was because my mother said I was destroying the furniture. So I do remember our couch when I was young, and it had a solid mm-hmm. armrest, and I could flip over the armrest onto the couch itself. And, you know, I mean, obviously, why not do that over and over and over again? Mm-hmm. And so I do remember my even little tumble-tot gymnastics classes mm-hmm. and just being just loving it, loving rolling around and flipping around and bouncing on the trampoline and all those things.
Well, what was it about it that really caught you?
I think the power in mm-hmm. it, honestly, the ability to fly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I pretty quickly moved up and was able to do back handsprings and back tucks and things. And then I was doing back tucks on the beam and, mm-hmm. you know, just like kind of feats of strength and mm-hmm. Being able to do more chin-ups than the boys, right?
Yeah.
Like just feeling really in touch with my body and really in touch with where my body was in space.
Mm-hmm.
I still have gymnastics dreams, right? Where things where I know I physically could not do them anymore, but mm-hmm. my body and my mind don't really know that in my dreams. And so, mm-hmm. yeah, there were a lot of things about it, but the just like visceral experience of movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it captures us. And I love those, when you talk about the dreams that you still have about these movements, it's, to me, that's almost a sign of what our body craves, that it craves to move. It craves to be free and strong. And so even do you still practice gymnastics at all?
Not really. No. I mean, yeah, no.
So what do you do for that freedom and strength now?
I mean, I guess I do because we have a trampoline in the backyard. So I do a little bit of gymnastics. But yoga, mm-hmm. I do a lot of yoga now. I ski, and mm-hmm. I was skiing a lot until they shut down my resort. I rock climb. I got really into rock climbing mm-hmm. for many years. And so that was sort of my transition from gymnastics. I did some diving for a couple years, mm-hmm. but then really I think rock climbing for me replaced gymnastics because it is that strength and flexibility. Mm-hmm. But then you also have these fun puzzles you have to figure out in your yeah. head. So it's really Yeah.
That's always my favorite part for rock climbing as well. I'm an avid yogi. And then to get onto the rock wall, something I miss too, is that you get – it is. It's that puzzle. So it's that thinking brain and the moving body. And to me, it's just the best marriage of movement.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's just like you cannot not be in the now, right? Mm-hmm. When you're rock climbing, it is you and that rock, and that is all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Love that.
For safety, you must be in the now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so this whole history of movement, and then you how far did you go in competing in gymnastics? Because you got up to a pretty high level, as I understand.
I was
it.
A level 9, mm-hmm. yeah, and I was 16. And the book touches mm-hmm. on this, but well, the book is all about my mm-hmm. gymnastics coach was sexually abusive, mm-hmm. and so looking back now, it's really hard for me to say. You know, I was in a lot of physical pain, but mm-hmm. it was like low back pain and not like clear injuries. I permanently sprained my low back, you yeah. know? And when I reflect back now, I wonder how much of that was actually mental, emotional pain mm-hmm. that was, you know. And so I quit gymnastics because I thought I had outgrown it. I was a whole 112 pounds or something, you know, yeah. and didn't think I could do it for 6 more years mm-hmm. through college. And my coach was leaving. And so all those factors combined, I quit at level 9 and then transitioned immediately into diving, so springboard mm-hmm. diving. And so that was a pretty quick and easy transition. But, you know, gymnastics is funny because it took me a long time to separate out, like, the good of gymnastics and mm-hmm. the not so good of gymnastics. And so writing the book really helped me to do that. And I can, my daughter's in gymnastics now. Yeah. I can be in a gym and be happy and feel safe and like everything's okay. Mm-hmm. But there was a while there, you know, that was really tough for me to even walk into a gym. Mm-hmm.
And so in that process of, you know, in that while when you're walking into the gym and still kind of feeling that mixed history for you. Can you tell us a little bit what that's like, or even, you know, dive into that journey and your
sure.
success after?
Yeah. So I did diving for a couple more years mm-hmm. in high school. Then I went on to college, and the first year I didn't coach or do any, you know, I was not in a gym at all. Mm-hmm. I may have gone back to my old gym once or twice in those years just to like say hello to the people that were still there and were yeah. still my people, but it was real hard going into that gym. And then I was asked by a friend to do some coaching for him because he, you know, he was a college gymnast. We had done gymnastics together. He went on to Ohio State to do college gymnastics, and he needed somebody to fill in some classes that he had been coaching. And so I went and did that. Mm-hmm. And working with the little ones, it was really good. And then somehow, I don't know how I even made this connection, but I ended up getting a coaching position for the little team, like the level 4s, level 5s. Mm-hmm. And it renewed my faith in the sport. I really fell back in love with the sport itself, but how great of an influence a gymnastics coach can mm-hmm. be on a kid's life. And so I just loved those girls. So I coached for about 2.5 years through college and just really embraced it again and mm-hmm. and talked, you know, probably didn't talk too much about what had happened to me, but kept my eye out for sure on that gym mm-hmm. and those kids. And so that was pretty early on after the abuse, probably like 4 years later I was coaching, and then had that wonderful experience. And then after college, moved out to Breckenridge mm-hmm. And ended up coaching at their rec center for a few years, and loved that too because I had never experienced kind of that YMCA rec center type of gymnastics program. Mm-hmm. And those girls got so good so quick. It was so fun to work with them. And yeah, and so it was – yeah, just a lot of fun.
I love seeing this joy on your face as you're talking about coaching these girls and coaching the littles. But I imagine it was an interesting duality at the time that you still had this hypervigilant eye on, because you know the worst of what can happen in the gymnastics studio and that coach and gymnast relationship. It's certainly something that has been in the news quite a bit over the years. But then to still have that space in yourself where you know the best of what can happen too.
Absolutely.
And we'll speak more to the worst here in a little bit. But what do you remember as the best? What's bringing that smile to your
yeah.
face?
It's those girls that like maybe even shouldn't, right? Like weren't a gymnast body that mm-hmm. come in. And I honestly, when I walked into their team at first, I was like, oh, wow. Like this is mm-hmm. not the gymnastics I know. Because when I was in Ohio coaching at a club, they actually taught me how we should get our girls to get nines on every event every single time before we move them up. Mm-hmm. Whereas I felt like in my gymnastics career, it was like once you got the skills, you were moving up to the next level. And that could have been partly because of my ability level. Like mm-hmm. I had to work really hard to get new skills. And so once I would get them, like I'd been there for a while and they wanted to push me on. But to see how perfecting something mm-hmm. can make, first of all, way less injuries, right? And so much more confidence in those kids when they did move up to that next level and had to struggle for a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. So when I came into the gym in Breckenridge and it was just, you know, like they just didn't have that much technique or anything. And as I applied what I knew and how I knew how to really teach skills, oh my gosh, a kid who like was the runner that always kind of had her elbows flying out and stuff like that, next thing I knew, she had a round off back handspring and a really nice one, you know, and I was like, wow, yeah, like just to watch how quickly kids can pick things up and really get good at them. Because, you know, they're just little pliable beings.
the plasticity all over.
Exactly.
Their limbs, their brains, their hearts.
Absolutely.
It's amazing.
It was joyful for sure.
I like that approach. It's not something that I'd heard before. My daughter's in gymnastics and more of a playful endeavor. And she's, mm-hmm. you know, she's 3.5. So it's certainly just where are your knees and elbows is kind of where we're at now.
Yes.
But to hear this idea of perfecting until you hit that 9 and then moving on, there's something that seems very satisfying about that because you can't skip the foundational skills.
Absolutely.
You can't hit a 9 if you haven't drilled all of the things that should be rote and then move on. And to
exactly.
the point of injury, I think that's a really great thing to bring up, that that's how you can avoid those, you know, silly back injuries.
Absolutely.
Like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you're not strong enough to do a perfect handstand, then mm-hmm. you really shouldn't be doing back handsprings and all the other things mm-hmm. because a back handspring involves a handstand, right?
Yeah.
So all those things. Yeah. I really, really appreciated that gym that I worked at in Ohio and how their attention to detail and like, no, they're not moving up until it's right on, you know.
Building the layers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Lay the foundation well and then the rest will be mm-hmm. hopefully less injurious, you know.
And I'm curious then, because you did go into a career of healthcare and homeopathy and then sort of these alternative medicines.
Uh-huh.
But to me, and maybe to our listeners, I hope, it makes a lot of sense that if you're dealing with an appreciation for foundational and growth, mm-hmm. even if it's in movement and gymnastics, that certainly layers itself into healthcare as well. Do you see any patterns there
Absolutely.
In your approach to that?
Yeah. So yeah. that's why I called my business homeopathy first, because I truly believe that if everybody had a homeopath, mm-hmm. we would need many fewer doctor visits, many fewer doctors,
mm-hmm.
and long-term care and all the things. Like it to me is a great foundation.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned a bunch of different things there. Like I actually, so everything is so intertwined with my
right.
life. My gymnastics coach left to go to chiropractic college.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was a big influence on me of like, you're smart, you should go be a chiropractor. And so I had been seeing a chiropractor as a gymnast and I felt like it helped me.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I had a lot of back pain. And so like, you know, looking back now, which is what?
Yeah.
And he used to adjust me before he was ever a chiropractor.
Oh, okay.
So
well, we kind of frown on that just to
exactly.
go right out.
We frowned yeah. on many of the things that man did.
Mm-hmm.
So that got intertwined in my brain too.
Mm-hmm.
And so all through college, I studied pre-med. So I kind of had the whatever you're going to do with healthcare.
Yeah.
Got into chiropractic college and really was excited about the schooling, but was not that excited about starting a business 4 years later with $150,000 worth of debt.
It's a certain kind of fun, I'll tell you that.
I'm sure it is. And now, full circle, I do own my own business, mm-hmm. but I deferred chiropractic college for a year and moved to Breckenridge and just had too much fun in the mountains. And then I was like, I don't think I can do that. So I pulled back, spent a couple years playing around and ended up working in a family practice office
mm-hmm.
to think about going to PA school. And what I found that I loved in that family practice office was the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
The relationship that doctor had with her patients and the way that people would just tell her everything. Like that is what I really connected with, was not so much the way medicine was happening there,
mm-hmm.
But she did a different kind of family practice too, where she spent an hour with her patients. Mm-hmm. And so that was super attractive to me. So small town family practice caught my heart because of the relationship, not because of allopathic Western medicine model. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah.
But when you have that kind of relationship and you have an hour to listen and really hear what is going on in your patient's life, you get to understand a lot of what's happening in that homeopathic, in that salutogenic kind of sphere of health.
Absolutely.
That you might miss in a 7-minute visit.
Absolutely.
Or you will miss.
You will.
Because
you,
no might.
Yeah, I describe it this way. Like in an allopathic visit, it's like narrowing down, narrowing down, narrowing down, narrowing mm-hmm. down. Whereas in my homeopathic consults, it's like we start with this one thing and then we open it up and open it up mm-hmm. and open it up. And I love that. Like that's where you start to really figure out the connections and what, you know, the root mm-hmm. is.
And how do you help explain that to your clients and patients as far as I feel like generally we are rather trained to go into that narrowing down, knock the symptom off. And now what is the specific thing that I have? Kind of now more than ever, we're being asked to do
yes.
that. How do you say, okay, this is going to get a lot more complicated, but honestly, it's going to be easier?
Yeah. So the way I usually tell people before an initial consultation mm-hmm. is, you know, we're going to talk about your thing, the reason that you're here, what mm-hmm. you want to see change, all that. But then I'm going to ask you all kinds of different questions that may not seem like they relate to this at all. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to get this big picture of who you are, because a homeopathic remedy isn't for your disease. It's mm-hmm. for you. So I could have 5 different people with asthma, and I will give them likely 5 different remedies because I'm treating the person and not the asthma.
Mm-hmm.
And usually people are pretty quick to be like, oh, I get to talk about everything. Cool. Because nobody gets to talk about everything mm-hmm. unless you're seeing a therapist consistently. Like, when's the last time you sat down and talked about yourself for an hour?
That's true. Maybe you're a guest on a podcast.
Exactly.
No, but it's
Thank
true.
You.
But it's true, because when you need to know that there is such a little piece of time and I have to give you what I think are the most important, you know, top 5 hits for the thing I'm coming in with.
Yes.
We are kind of undependable self-selectors, given that most of us don't have a medical background and, you know, the symptoms and this is what I'm feeling, sure, but wouldn't know what to mention. And my favorite phrase that comes out of any interaction in my office is, this probably has nothing to do with this, but.
Yes.
And it has everything to do with it.
It's the magic, right?
It is.
Yeah.
And to me, it's sort of that individual intuition of, I don't know what it has to do with it, but I can't stop thinking of it.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that gut. Like,
yeah.
Just like, this is just weird, and I think I should tell you this.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Maybe there's something here.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where do you focus your practice now? How's your practice morphed and grown?
Right. So I worked as a PA for mm-hmm. almost 10 years with a doctor who was an MD that did homeopathy. And during that time, I was like boots on the ground, family mm-hmm. practice in a tiny little town. And so I always refer to it as like I was Doc Baker from the Little House on the Prairie, right? Like anything and everything could walk in that door. And it might be 5:50, you know, mm-hmm. and I was supposed to go home at 5:00, but somebody walks in with a laceration and I'm there till 7 sewing them up.
Mm-hmm.
So I love that aspect of family practice too, of just like fixing the thing. And, you know, the relationships that were built there were great because I didn't see more than 20 patients a day, rarely.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really did have time. But I've been thinking about it a lot. Like, so I was also learning homeopathy, and then that kind of trickled in slowly because I was new to homeopathy and I didn't really know what I was doing. Everybody just wanted to see the doctor. But as he was getting older and getting closer to retirement, I started taking on more homeopathic cases, and then it was great because I could just ask him, like, this is what I'm thinking, but mm-hmm. I'm not sure. And so I had this beautiful mentorship that most PAs do not get, especially learning an actual different modality too.
Yeah.
And then I had a kiddo, mm-hmm. and that, you know, I really wanted to shift back to part-time. And the organization that I worked for was a big federally qualified health center, which mm-hmm. was great, except for they didn't want me to go to part-time. And so they would allow me to go to part-time, but I would lose all my vacation. I would only have 1 week a year. And I had worked my way up and just a lot of things where I was like, this isn't working for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I left that organization and went to another like rural health clinic basically and worked there for about a year doing homeopathy too, but that quickly showed like you can't pay the bills with it. The other organization mm-hmm. was big. They had a grant for complementary alternative medicines. Mm-hmm. So homeopathy in a Western medical office just can't pay the bills.
No.
So I stopped. Well, and in that period of time, my doctor that I had learned from mm-hmm. had gotten sick and passed away.
Oh, I'm so
and
sorry.
And so, yeah, that was a hard one. And so he passed away right around the time that my daughter, well, I was really pregnant with my daughter at his funeral. And so then I had her, and then I had already like noticed like I can't keep doing homeopathy here. So I split my practice, and I was a homeopath down the street, and I was a PA in the medical practice, and I gradually just worked it so that I was dropping hours as a PA and working hours up as a homeopath mm-hmm. and got to the point where I could fill a full time or a part-time schedule just doing homeopathy.
Oh, how fabulous.
Oh, it was great. It was great because I could really be like, I know medicine, but I choose this, mm-hmm. you know? And it was fantastic.
And I think there is such a great gift to have both. And I always kind of bemoan that I have always been in an alternative field and that is what I know. But to be able to speak both languages because
exactly.
As people are asking more questions and starting to understand the impact of diet and lifestyle choices on their overall health, still, you know, so many Americans are on prescription medications and are under the care of a traditionally trained allopathic doctor.
Right.
That you really need to be able to be a mediator on that bridge
exactly.
away from those pharmaceuticals and their, you know, effects that are not the ones that we would desire, so-called side effects, the impact of those. So the fact that you can speak both languages and then choose to treat through homeopathy is just an amazing gift.
I love it. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I can also say, I think you might want to ask your doctor about this.
Mm-hmm.
Or when they say I'm on this, this, and this, I can be like, oh yeah, I know what all those things do. You know,
yeah.
And so I do. I have that in my pocket and I can kind of be their mediator of like, okay, mm-hmm. I know they've done this, this, and this, but maybe they might want to check this lab or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not giving them medical advice. It's just giving them education of mm-hmm. what they might want to look into and ask their doctor about. And so
yeah.
I think a lot of my patients really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Understood. I appreciate that.
it really is that because when it comes down to it, the medications that we are on are as much a part of our lifestyle impact as the amount of sleep that we get, the food that we eat, what we hydrate or don't hydrate with, and our movement.
Absolutely.
And if you don't know the side effects or the interactions, then, you know, you're maybe trying to figure out why you have a chronic headache. And is it the food? Is it the sleep? Is it the sun? Is it the this? But if no one asks about the medication, you know,
right.
you'd be going down all the wrong rabbit holes.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So you have now this amazing homeopathic practice.
Yes.
And growing in small town still.
Yes. I was in California mm-hmm. at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then what brought you here to Colorado?
So I had by that time two children. So I have a boy and a girl.
Mm-hmm.
This was 2015. And I had, well, yeah, we skipped a part, but we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
My husband's job changed such that he was not as excited about it as he
mm-hmm.
had been. So, like, he still had a job, but he wasn't like, I love this job. And the air quality where we were living was really poor.
Mm-hmm.
And so those two factors and the education system there was a little bit rough too, but it was mostly the air quality and him not really loving his job. My brother was up here. He had gone to school at School of Mines.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was always going to be either California or Colorado. And so we just started looking for jobs. We figured then was the time right before my kiddo started kindergarten. And he got this amazing job in Aurora. And
fabulous.
Literally like 3 weeks later, we were in Colorado with our van and our truck and our everything. And so it happened really fast. And just recently, I've had some like regrets, if you will, mm-hmm. mainly because it was a very diverse community there.
Yeah.
And we are not where we are now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think right now more than ever, I just feel like I let them down, you know?
Yeah.
So it was not an easy move. I had this amazing house that I just loved mm-hmm. and a pool in the backyard and fabulous friends.
Mm-hmm.
But we just felt like as a family, we wanted to get back into the mountains, if you
yeah.
will. Because in California where we were, like the mountains were right there, but they're much harder to access. And so a lot of different reasons. Mm-hmm. But when I did move, then it really was a big hit on my practice because mm-hmm. I had built my practice there and it was really solid. And so a lot of my patients were not quick to jump on Zoom. a lot of people did. I kept it open and allowed for the, you know, Zoom consultations.
There you go.
sorry. But it was definitely a big dip. And mm-hmm. I landed in a new area where I had two kids that were, you know, littles and trying to get into school and all the things. And so I didn't like jump right back into like, I'm going to build out this practice huge. I had mm-hmm. mom duties for a while there.
Yeah.
And then I got motivated to write this book. Mm-hmm. And so I've kind of, you know, I've been playing in that entrepreneurial world ever since I started my business. But I did a stint. It was like a 9-month align your business with your life kind of business development, self-development mm-hmm. thing that led to me opening my eyes to like, I could write a book. Like I know people that have written books now. And it just helped me to open up like maybe this isn't all that I want to do forever. Mm-hmm. That's also where I learned about masterminding. And I just fell in love with the power of a group of people. A small group of people coming together regularly and supporting one another can do phenomenal things. And so I trained to then facilitate masterminds, and I've done that for a while now too. And so, you know, just I like started opening up this bubble of like, well, what else can I do?
Well, and I think that I have a couple of different directed thoughts. But what I love, just to agree with the mastermind concept, is that what I think something we've stopped appreciating maybe on a grander scale is how we really are kind of tribal people, and that we are meant to have our group and to be championed and supported. And, you know, mothers are not meant to be the single adult for their children and wear all the hats any yes. more than we are meant to be single entrepreneurs responsible for everything, when we can have that group championing and seeing our blind spots and seeing what we don't see in ourselves.
Absolutely.
And so to have that mastermind and that piece. Yeah. But also the way you care for others and the way you care when you start talking about homeopathy and these really holistic ways of looking at the body is that there is healing that comes in all directions. And that includes, you know, the book that you ended up writing
yes.
and the pieces
yeah.
that came from that.
Absolutely.
So tell us a little bit about the book and the journey, because it was a lifetime journey
yes.
to write the book.
Yes, it was. So the 5-minute version of the book is my gymnastics coach was, let's see, he was 15 years older than me. Mm-hmm. And I got on his team when I was in like 8th grade. But I had known him in the gym for a year or two prior to that. He came to our gym when I was 11. And I knew him well, mm-hmm. you know. And
how did you know him before that?
Before I was on his yeah. team, mm-hmm. because he was in the gym and mm-hmm. I was in the gym uh-huh. a lot, and everybody knew everybody. And he was this, like, they called him Mr. Wonderful. He was this extremely charismatic, friendly, loving, loud, just everybody loved him. You mm-hmm. know, he was just this guy that everybody was drawn to, you know. And so even before I was on his team, we traveled to Australia when I was 11. I turned 12 in Australia. So 1988, we went to the World's Fair there, and he was on that trip. And that was the first time I feel like really I remember hanging out with him, and I remember, you know, joking around with him and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And so gradually over the course of 2 to 3 years, then I got on his team when I was 13, I think. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I remember the first time something where I was like, huh. I was standing up on this platform because we didn't have pits at our gym. And so we had a platform that went into like a soft pit.
Gotcha.
And he was like, you can't get down until you tell me you love me. And I was like, I'm not telling you that. I was all sassy. But everybody yeah. told him they loved him. Like, and he told everybody he loved them. And mm-hmm. so like, I just hadn't done it yet, I don't think. And he caught wind of that, something. But he like stood in front of me, and he was a bodybuilder, right? And mm-hmm. so he was big and 6'2" and 220 pounds. And I was, you know, 80 pounds maybe.
And 15 years younger.
and 15 years younger and yeah. tiny. And I just remember that as being like weird. And finally I gave in, and I was like, yeah, whatever, I love you. You know, mm-hmm. like sassy. But then just gradually, and my parents had divorced too. So mm-hmm. I was living in a new town, and I wasn't living with my brother. They had split my brother and I up. So, you know, the household, the life at home was hard. And
he
was a person that would talk to me about it and ask how things were going and ask about my brother and my dad. And so just gradually he started, you know, I love your abs. Can I touch your abs? You know, things like that. And just this grooming process. Yeah. And then telling me stories about sexual encounters he had had with girlfriends. And it, knowing it was not appropriate, but like we're friends, right? Like he thinks of me as a peer or he wouldn't tell me these things.
It's kind of that culture of intimacy and it's okay in this container, right. Even if the container's not okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, one of my other teammates who was older than me, I knew from another friend that she was involved with him. Oh. And that's how we thought of it, involved with him, right? Mm-hmm. Not being molested or raped or anything, like they were together. And back in that...
What a shiny word to put on it.
Right?
Yeah.
But that's how we viewed it then. Uh-huh. And so writing the book, because this is what the book is about, it took me a lot of digging back into like, how would we have even said it at that age? Because it's a big concept to try and wrap your head around as an adult looking back. Mm-hmm. But as a child, when we were talking about these things, so that was my close friend who then we went to a camp together and she told me herself. So a year or so went by between me knowing, but then her telling me herself. Mm-hmm. And then by that time, I was probably 14, almost 15, and we're on the same team. She's like the better gymnast. I'm, you know, younger and not as good. And she would get, she started getting a little bit like, something going on with you guys? And I was like, no, you know, no, because nothing had gone on physically. However, he would do things like spot me onto my vault and his hand would just graze and he'd be like, I'm just trying to get some practice, like joking, right? Joking around all
brushing
the time.
Brushing it off even though.
Right.
Yeah.
So in the midst of that year, before he was leaving, he got married. Mm-hmm. We were at his wedding together. I still know that she is fully involved with him. Mm-hmm. He's married now. He has a child.
Oh, my goodness.
And then the spring right before he was leaving, we had I had my, like, last chance to qualify for nationals and fell off the beam five times. Just, like, total reflecting back. Well, I was in no emotional state to be, you know. So we went into a rest stop, and he kissed me on the mouth.
Oh, my.
And then multiple other times in the matter of a month or two, he kissed me. And then she and I both spent the night at his house one night.
So he went right into escalating it very quickly.
Yeah. And thankfully for me, I was still like pushing back. And so I never let him go below the belt. Like I said no to him, but it was, you know, it was, I was kissing him and it was just, I felt so in my mind, in my 15-year-old brain, I had cheated on my first boyfriend ever. I had betrayed my friendship. And I had been in an adulterous relationship, right? Like all those things happened in kissing this man. And so,
to have all of that be to the language of your 15-year-old brain, it was all your fault.
Right. And, absolutely.
And the turning of it is that there was nothing generous, air quotes, there's nothing inappropriate about what he's been doing. You made all of the mistakes.
Right.
And what... what a lens to have to shift and turn around from and the burden on your 15-year-old heart.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. So thank God that my friend and I had each other, because we're just going to fast forward. She and I did not – we saw each other once in college and it was a bad thing. It was like she melted down and so I was like, I am not good for her. We basically didn't speak for about 12 years. And then I was 30, and then I called off an engagement, and then I dug back through. I had kept these letters from him for 15 years. They had traveled with me. I don't even know how many different apartments I lived in. But I pulled them out, and I started reading them, and I had broken off this engagement, was just wrecked about that, so started seeing a counselor. The third appointment that I went to, I brought the three most incriminating letters from my coach, and I just like I walked in and I laid them down and I was like, read those, I'm going to the bathroom. Like still so afraid of it, you know, like so just awfully like shameful and regretful and icky and all that. And I had this amazing male therapist and he just looked at me and he said, who are these from? And I was like, my gymnastics coach, he was 15 years older than me, you know. He's like, I need to make a CPS report. And I was like, really? Like, you know, I
you
was
didn't know that was
well, I was a mandated reporter, right? Like I could not put my knowledge onto my own story. I couldn't see it clearly for what it was until he validated it like that. And I was like, really? It's been 15 years. Are you sure? You know?
Yeah.
And so he did. And that got me digging into like statutes of limitations and what I knew went on with my friend. And so I reached out to her and I said, hey, how you doing? You know, and I said, I have a house and a dog and a good job and, you know, life is okay. And she wrote back and she said, I have a house and a dog and a good job too. And then I just unloaded, like, I can't keep a relationship straight. And have you ever seen a counselor? And all, like, just kind of like unleashed, like, are you okay? Basically, like, cause I'm not.
Yeah.
And we jumped on the phone and we had these like parallel lives. We're like successful on the outside, not functioning very well in relationships. And so we decided to go to the police, and I was like really adamant about it because he had moved back to the area and he was treating gymnasts from our gym, because he's at this time now a chiropractor and a physician assistant. And that combination, I knew, like, he just has too much access.
So that's a lot of power. It's a lot of trust. And
intimacy. Mm-hmm. Like, you're in a room alone, oftentimes putting your hands on people. And that, I think, was another big tactic of his with gymnastics. He was touching us all the time, right? Yeah. So we were so used to being touched by him, being held by him, being caught by him, you know? And so I just, when I knew the gymnasts were going to him, I was like not on my watch. And so I reached out to her and she was like a little bit, like, it was a whole bigger story for her. You know, it was a lot more years of it. It was a lot. She lived back there. And I'm just so proud of the fact that she would let me help her and and not that I helped her, we helped each other, right? Like, we just held hands and walked into the police department and made a report.
you got to see each other for what you couldn't see in yourself.
Totally. And so we made the report. It sat on the prosecutor's desk for like 7 months or something. And then miraculously, a woman from his chiropractic office came in and made a report against him. And I had also done a tapped phone call to him. And on that tapped phone call, he admitted 8 or 9 counts of rape with my friend. So that was fantastic. But they still didn't move because it was 15 years old. And, you know, the guy's an upstanding doctor and then, you know, like all the things. But when that other woman came forward, that tipped it. And then they dropped our reports on his table at the end of his interview about what happened at the chiropractic office, go ahead.
I was going to say, and how was he approaching that?
He explained it all away with all his anatomy books and this is what we do and it's fine and it's normal. And it, probably if it had been just that, he would not have been arrested. But with the reports that they had from us, which comes to a point that I always tell people, like, if in doubt, make a report. And it's not necessarily for you. It's for the next person that comes to make a report. So it validates their report, right? Like when you can talk about the language that they use and the way that they do things, like corroborating stories. Is that the word? Yes.
Yeah.
Is good. And so.
But it speaks to sort of human nature. And Malcolm Gladwell talked about this a lot and is talking to strangers, is that we're not going to go to the bias of distrusting someone that we trust that has that upstanding position in the community and that is known for, you know, being a doctor, being an amazing coach, Mr. Wonderful.
Larry Nassar, right? Yeah. Like, yeah.
It takes all of the information to tip the scale, and it becomes that last snowflake that creates the avalanche.
Exactly.
So at the least, your report is a snowflake, but that snowflake is powerful.
It is. It is. And so they arrested him that night. He got out on bail. Took another year or so, and we ended up in a 5-day-long jury trial because he pled not guilty. I mean, he was offered 4 years in prison and 15 years as a registered sex offender, and he wouldn't take it. And so he went to 5-day-long jury trial, and he ended up getting 43 years in prison.
Oh, my goodness. Congratulations for the culmination.
Thank you. Yes.
And amazing that he still wouldn't plead guilty, even with the tapped phone call, even with all of the evidence against him. He wanted to keep explaining it away, I suppose.
It was interesting. It was interesting. And so what was really fascinating to me is when I first saw him after probably 14 years or so, my first inclination was to go up and hug him. You know, I mean, like, it's so rooted in you, like, how you interact with a person. And then as I watched him just blatantly lie on the stand and and tell these just ridiculous stories to make something look like it could have been this way, I could really start to see him for who he was. And it was hard. It was hard to watch that of somebody who I loved for so many years. And even with everything I knew at that point and with making a police report, it was still difficult. And so that was in 2008. And then I started writing the book in 2016. like literally I'm writing the book and the Larry Nassar stuff is coming up on the news. It was, I feel like there is this universal energy that brings things when it's supposed to bring things.
Well, and the stories have so much parallel in the way of explaining away treatment and explaining away a touch. It's, you know, it's all there.
Yes. Thankfully, I think for those girls, it wasn't like a, at least most of them, it wasn't like a love relationship. He didn't try and make it like, oh, I love you. This is why I'm doing this. You know what I mean? Like it was really like a weird sadistic medical thing that he was trying to pass it off as.
Yeah.
But watching all those gymnasts talk about it and as I'm writing this book, and I really couldn't even watch that much of that. So I wasn't in tune with everything going on with that. But I felt like the reason that I needed to write the book was because it was a hopeful story on this topic. And I felt like there were so many not hopeful, like really sad stories about rapes that are reported on college campuses and then they're never even actually reported because the campus police don't think it's worth it. All these things where I feel like women are basic – women, men, victims are basically told, I don't know that you should even report on that. You know,
don't worry.
Like – we've got to hear the hopeful stories of like this was worthwhile. It was hard, but it was worthwhile. And so, I mean, if I was going to write a book ever, this is the hardest book that I could write. So I had to start with that one. And as I went back and did it, it was extremely cathartic for sure. But I think like I thought I was writing it for my children, which I think I did to a huge degree because I think when I see clients who hit the age they were when they were victimized, they start to get really emotional with their kids and maybe locking them down too much and things like that. And so it was definitely for my children. But by the end of it, it really opened my eyes to the societal nuances that I was exposed to that allowed it to happen. You know, and how those things are unfortunately still very much a piece of our society. And it's not as bad as it was in the 80s to some degree, but there's a lot of it that's just gone more underground, right? It's just more subtle. It's just more.
It's a constant unraveling. And to your point before about, you know, and I love where you kept opening this up to, how very homeopathic of you to keep opening up to, that it's not just women. And then it's not just men. It's not just children. It is the idea of victims across the board.
Yes.
And I think so often now there's a very large conversation happening about the systems that perpetrate the victimization of people for a grand number of reasons. And then the layers of trauma that continue from that. And it continues to put the onus on the victims. And it creates these patterns that come when you talk about trauma that's happened and then their children are at that age and it revisits the family. What I love about the story you've told and that I'm excited to read in the book is that you're not just talking about incident and punishment. It's so much more than that when it comes to how you even knowing what you know as a physician's assistant and provider about being an obligate reporter. It took somebody else needing to see you.
Yeah.
And even though now you see that these letters are inappropriate, you still felt the need to hug him because you needed to unlearn the relationship that was instilled in you.
Yes.
The nuances and complications of how this grooming and victimization happens are subtle, require patience and empathy and space to understand. And I don't feel like they're given that kind of air.
Absolutely.
And so thank you for making that the point of your message, to be that reporter, to be that tipping point, hopefully.
Yes. Well said. Yes. I saw Tarana Burke speak a couple years ago, and the thing that just has stuck with me ever since is she said there's a massive amount of unlearning that we need to do. And I mean, right now, what's going on with everything in our country right now, there's so much we need to unlearn about how we treat people. And it's just, I feel like if, and I, you know, I started reading a lot about race after I finished this book. And I think it's because I feel like I have this window into oppression as being a white woman, you know, and my story. But like that window, if I can open that window up, maybe I can be a bridge again. Like I'm a bridge from a homeopathic provider to an allopathic provider. Maybe I can be a bridge to my white husband and all the good white men in my life of how we feel about the things that they do sometimes and then why it might translate into different people of different colors and different races and all the things, you know, like, and I can't claim to know anything, you know, but I'm starting that journey and I'm trying and I feel like we're supposed to screw up because if we're not screwing up, we're not talking about it enough.
It's true.
And so I'm trying.
But you bring a really good point, and to that large bubble of victimization is that we can only start with that nugget of empathy within ourselves. And the lost opportunity, can I say that? The lost opportunity in these horrible things that can happen is if you hold that small nugget and say, it's only me. And this is only how I feel, and this is only about me and my story. Versus you talk about the systemic unlearning. And if there's systemic unlearning within the field of, within the practice of gymnastics and coaching and all that has come out, and you're not the only woman, but if there's grooming and pressure, and you know that you as a white woman in this position have that small nugget of what someone with more and more and more layers of othering, it becomes that balloon that can open up and start to shine understanding in that I don't live what you live. I don't know what you know, but I know it's not right.
Yes.
Yeah.
I hope so. Yeah. Right. I mean, like, I do feel like the hopefulness is what we need to look at more than anything is like, yes, this is all good stuff that's happening. It's hard and it's good.
It becomes... it makes everything so unstable. And I think that's what becomes really hard because as humans, we want to have things controlled. We want to know what's next. We need that safety. And I even imagine you unlearning this relationship with this coach in the courtroom. Everything was unstable.
Yeah.
But when things are unstable, they can change.
Yeah.
And when things are rigid, you know exactly what's going to happen next.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, so the book writing was 8-10 years later. I actually found like full forgiveness in the book writing, whereas I didn't. The courtroom was like, I felt justice. You know, I felt gratitude for all the people that got that verdict for us, you know, the jury and the judge and all the people that supported us. But I didn't feel forgiveness at all yet. In fact, I had a lot more like work on that to do because he was a totally different person, right? But I think there's a lot going on in my head right now, even reflecting back to when I worked as a family practitioner, you know, in this small town. And the talk right now about potentially defunding the police, I think is fantastic. And it's not because I think we don't need police. It's because I think about the times where I was this, you know, young girl in this small town. And there were things going on in my little medical practice where I was like, this is not a 911 call. This is not really a sheriff's call, but I don't have anyone else to call, right? So this morning on my way here, I was thinking, wouldn't it be cool if we had like 911 for the actual police with guns, and we had like 811 for like a social worker, and we had 711 for like a doctor, right? Like, you know, when somebody falls from a heart attack, paramedics show up maybe, but sometimes it's the fire department, you know what I mean? Like, if we had the right people to call all the time, it would be such a different space for us. Because rarely do we hopefully really need guns, right?
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I think that like that whole learning too of just like reflecting back on my life in ways that it I can relate to that. I can relate to needing help, but not needing cops necessarily, not needing police, but needing help. Like I am not equipped to do this thing or manage this situation. But gosh, social worker on demand would be amazing.
Oh my goodness, wouldn't it? and that was my first thought, particularly as everything started to go sideways in this glorious year of 2020, is that we're going to find, and maybe it's starting to look at a system of resources, but that we're,
absolutely.
To me, I sat, you know, gap-jawed at social workers and mental health workers that to me became part of the true front lines of this space that we're holding to keep everybody safe and to be that resource to turn to. So often they are the ones connecting to, and then what's next? Like your therapist in the letters. But how often, and across the board, again, we're just talking layers and layers, how often do we not get get the care we need, mental, emotional, physical, because the provider that we're seeing doesn't have the next resource.
Yeah.
We're just human. We can't know everything. This white coat worship needs to just go away.
Stop.
Just stop. We're practicing medicine.
Yes.
We need to know the next person to know.
Yes.
So that we can all keep going on our journeys.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. But I'm really curious about, it feels like such a fine point, but such an important one, the difference between the justice served and the forgiveness given.
Oh, yeah.
And your engagement with that and where you found that forgiveness and maybe how that felt different or vindicated you differently.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So the name of the paper back in my hometown where mm-hmm. like all this was publicized when it was going on is called The Vindicator.
Oh.
It's so weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, the forgiveness was a really interesting piece
mm-hmm.
because you don't want to dive this far into this story. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. you as a person who has this story, like thinking about going back and like really writing the nitty gritty of it, like people don't really want to do that. There, mm-hmm. I looked up like rape memoirs, whatever, mm-hmm. things like that. And I read a few, but I didn't really want to dive into that myself. But there mm-hmm. aren't that many out there. And so, at least from my little mini research before.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I did have a block, but I read some really great memoir. But as I was writing it and I really put myself in my 15-year-old shoes, mm-hmm. that's where I could do it because I think I had to forgive myself before I could forgive him.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a documentary, and I'm going to forget the name of it, but it's about a woman who was sexually violated by like her running coach and her – it was a couple. It was mm-hmm. like a male-female couple that abused her. And in the final scene of that movie, she like addresses him, but then she goes back into like a bathroom and she's crying and her little self is next to her.
Wait,
I know, right? Like it's super intense. But what was bad about it to me was that it was almost like she, the adult human, was a mess. Mm-hmm. And the little girl next to her was kind of like patting her on the back. And I was like, mm-hmm. that is the exact opposite of what I was. I was mm-hmm. the adult human that could go back and hug my little girl self.
Mm-hmm.
And give her forgiveness that it wasn't her fault, you know?
Yeah.
And so once I did that, then I could really look at him as the human that he was and how, you know, all the things that must have happened to him that led to him not knowing how to show love to us. Because mm-hmm. I do believe that he really loved us and he just didn't have good boundaries on how to show that mm-hmm. love, and something had happened to him or whatever. And so to that point, like had he stopped and never continued doing it, then he wouldn't probably be in prison right now, right? Like,
yeah.
But he couldn't stop. And that's why he needs to be where he is. But yeah, I got to the point where I could like feel love for him again, even because mm-hmm. there were so many good things that he taught me. And one of them that I remember, there's two quotes that he would say all the time or something. And I wrote them in a journal that I had back then. And one of them, which is just so ironic, is take yourself to raise. So don't blame your parents mm-hmm. and your life circumstance and everything, but like take yourself to raise. So he basically gave me the quote that put him in prison, if you think about it that way.
Yeah. Wow. That's
right?
Powerful. And don't we so often teach the thing that we're dying to hear?
Maybe, right? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So that's kind of the next book, right? Is teach the thing that I need to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. I that sense of forgiving yourself first, and to go back to as you first started telling this story and how you were responsible. You were the adulterer.
Absolutely.
You were the cheater. You were mm-hmm. wrong.
Yeah.
But you weren't. And
as a child.
You were a child.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some amazing modalities of therapy to do that kind of regression and to go back and find that forgiveness.
Yeah.
Because it does. When you can open that scope, again, blow open that bubble.
Exactly.
To see outside of that centered version of yourself. And that will take, in this case, it certainly means taking away the shame and the victimization that didn't belong to you.
Mm-hmm.
But it does put on that responsibility that did belong to you. And your responsibility was to be a kid.
Yeah.
Was to trust the adults around you.
Yeah.
And that's what you did.
Yeah.
And it puts then the responsibility on the adult for what he should have been doing, and to maybe see how you know, damaged he may or may not have been, but certainly how what he thought he was expressing was certainly not what was happening in reality.
Absolutely. Yeah, and we haven't even touched on the whole parental part of it, right? But that now of like having conversations with children and never calling anatomical parts something other than their true anatomical name, and making sure that from your children's age they know if anybody ever wants to look or take a picture or touch or wants them to touch, you know, all the things. Feather Burkhauer is a great resource in this area in Denver. Her workshop, Parenting Safe Children, is phenomenal about preventing sexual violation in kids. And so we've done that, my husband and I. And we also did Impact Personal Safety of Colorado has a family safety something class. Oh, my gosh. So awesome. So there are resources of like the prevention side of things, too, of like we don't have to just fix things once it's happened. Like you can prevent this stuff and you can give your children the language to know when it is absolutely okay to say no to an adult and when you should be telling your mom if weird conversations are happening about like, I mean, weird conversations about sex should not be happening with your gymnastics coach.
that's not the time nor the place nor the anything.
Not appropriate.
And when you talk about him being so charismatic and Mr. Wonderful and even, you know, needing that tipping point of your testimony to turn the tide on him, you know, I'm sure he was not just beguiling young girls. If he was that kind of beloved in the community, everybody needed to find that tipping point with him and see him for what he was, you know, that there's that parental side of it as well.
I mean, it's still like, as you're saying that, it's kind of a sad story on a lot of levels for me because like, I wish he was the guy that he seemed to be. I really do. My life would be a lot different if he was that guy.
Absolutely.
And so would a lot of other people's, I think.
Well, thank you for sharing your story and being brave enough and strong enough to go back and do the work and write out the nitty gritty. I mean, to go into that detail and share it with the world is no shortage of vulnerability and also no shortage of a gift for someone else who is looking for the hope and the success story to say it's worth speaking and it's worth finding the ears that'll listen.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Where can people find No Big Deal?
Amazon.
Excellent.
Yeah. Easy peasy. Yes.
Delivering.
Yeah.
And so what's next for you?
Next for me is a second book, I think. I've just, like, it's been brewing in there for a couple years. But the working title right now is Unstoppable Starts With You. Building Resiliency Through Pursuing Your Passion. So that's kind of a thread through my book. Like, my book, I touched on all the different things that helped me to heal because I was not a straight up, I'm going to get on antidepressants and I'm going to go see a therapist for 15 years. Like I learned, I healed through rock climbing. I healed through yoga. I healed through all these different things. And so I touch on that through that book. And I think I hear myself as I coach my clients in homeopathy, like, yeah, we talk about their homeopathic remedy, but then I'm like, okay, what are you doing for movement? What are you doing? What are you doing for quiet time? You know, and I basically just encourage them, find the things that you love that light you up because that's what's going to keep you afloat. If you're doing those things, even for 5 or 10 minutes a day, every day, then when the stuff goes down, because it's going to go down, your parents aren't going to live forever, you know, like things are going to happen and it's going to be hard. But if you have that cushion of resiliency built by your passions, you can get through anything. And so I did like a retreat with that same theme. And I've just kind of played with some things over the course of the last year, but it's just become like much clearer lately. And I think COVID helped me to see that of like, I have those things. I have my yoga practice and I have my meditation practice and I have those things, but there are so many people I meet that just don't have those grounding practices for themselves. And so it's, I hope it becomes what I think it could be.
It's the message I think we all need right now, because when it comes down to it, you're right. It's resiliency and it's our ability to cope with the unthinkable, you know, because if this year has taught us anything is that the unthinkable is coming. It came.
It arrived. It is.
You know,
yes.
Arguably it was thinkable. But, you know, we saw that something like this was on the horizon, but it's here. Yeah. And, you know, I found myself talking with my parents recently about, you know, what a tough 3 months this has been. And, but that I opened my journal to write, and I happened to open to June of 2019. And at that time, my father was going through cancer and my business was growing and we were launching the podcast and I had a 2-year-old and I was complaining about all the same interpersonal things that I'm complaining about today. And it was a really eye-opening, you know, when it comes down to it, there will always be something.
Absolutely.
Global, local, systemic, personal, there will always be something.
Yes.
And our ability to wade our way through it and come out the other side in this strength of show is that resilience. And we need to divorce ourselves from the idea that that resilience comes from a silver bullet, comes from one thing,
right.
The one thing that I did.
Right.
We need to have that meditation, that movement, that food, that breathwork, that relational practice, not for when it's easy.
Yes.
But for when all the shit hits the fan.
Exactly. Diversify your practices. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that whole, like, I started to feel like, oh, I'm this privileged white woman writing this book about how you should do more yoga, you know?
Yeah.
But it's not about that. It's more about like in the 5 minutes you have between your first and second job, that 5 minutes is better spent meditating than it is eating a cheeseburger, right? Like to be able to like break it down, because we need those people who are needing to work 2 or 3 jobs right now. We need them to be as strong as they can possibly be to help us make these changes.
Absolutely.
Because they're the ones who get it. They're the ones who need it. And so like I really believe that Unstoppable starts with you, right?
It does.
Like it's, if it's not, if you're not doing it for yourself, you can't expect other people to do it.
And I think there is a real urgency. So being in these kind of crisis situations, and I believe that is the gift of COVID, is that it has taken crisis onto everyone in a way that different levels of privilege could excuse us from many of the other ones that were already existing. You know, the flashlight is getting shined on those as well. But when you're not in crisis and you're at the privilege of space and money and food and all of the things that we have, you know, yoga means Lululemon. Yoga means getting into the studio. Yoga means getting that hour sweat in.
Yoga means getting into your bikini sometimes, right?
Yeah. Versus yoga means take some deep breaths and stretch and get in touch with your body.
Yes.
And that is truly what yoga means. Yoga means finding that grit between, you know, attachment and release. It's finding that relationship with your ego and your fear of death. And it's finding your breath. The asana, the physical practice of yoga, is like a blip on the history of it. We didn't get into our yoga training. But it's that physical world. Versus if you are in that crunched crisis mode and you are the individual working in those 2 to 3 jobs, and that's disproportionately, you know, people of color, and that's disproportionately in areas that have been defined by systemic oppression.
Absolutely.
That your only resource can become yourself.
Exactly. Yes.
And it's that breath.
And that's the best resource you've got. Like, you are your best resource, but you've got to know who you are and what you need, right?
And that is something that remains universal.
Absolutely.
But how you feel the pain of it and what you can write it off as with a commercialization, something to buy, something to achieve versus being present with yourself.
Yep. Yeah.
I'm excited for your next book.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
I am too.
Well, if people want to learn more about you, learn about your mastermind classes, where can they find you?
They can find me at two places. Homeopathy First, which is the number one ST, not the word, .com, and openspace4.com, openspace4.
Yeah. And all those will be linked in the show notes as well.
Great.
And certainly No Big Deal is available on Amazon. So certainly check that out.
Yes, I would love it. I just got a few emails recently from people who had just read it, and it's always just it's an honor when somebody reads that story and feels moved by it. And so, appreciate it.
What a beautiful gift.
Thank you. It's been so great to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining me. Thank you for sharing your story and going broad, going homeopathic with this conversation. I mean, just blowing that bubble up to see what that resilience and what that change can do to yourself, to the systems that you live in and the systems outside of your systems outside of you. We got to go big. We got to go big with our experiences and know there's a bridge to understanding.
massive unlearning.
So we will we will continue our unlearning and as we dive deeper into these lessons and further episodes. But thank you for joining us here today for today's episode of Healing Ground Movement Podcast. Look forward to seeing you next time.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed what you heard and got a little something out of it. Now remember, the information expressed in these interviews is for informational and not diagnostic or treatment purposes. However, I hope you find that having the right information and resources can go a long way to helping you on your healthcare journey. Ask the right questions and seek out professional help.